The following is an interview by Rebecca Polson with Brownie Thompson and Marge Ward, recorded January 2016 at Raven Studios in Sitka, Alaska.
I'm Dorothy Thompson, but I'm called Brownie, and I've been in Sitka since 1949.
I'm Marjorie Ward, better known as Marge, and I've also been in Sitka since 1949. Brownie came in July, and I came in November
June. That's okay.
We cheated you.
Who cares? I came to Alaska because a friend wanted to come to Alaska, and so I told her I would come here with her, and then we'd leave here, and I always thought I wanted to go to Hawaii. Well, at the last minute, she backed out. But I had applied, so I went through with my application and decided to come. And when I signed up, I was supposed to go to Bethel. But when I traveled to Seattle, they told me they were pulling me from Bethel and putting me in Sitka because they were short-handed and everyone was working 6 days. So I ended up in Sitka. I had been working in Iowa for a short time, and that's where I was raised. I'm a farm girl. I was a three-year nursing student under the cadet program during the war, and I graduated from Broadlands Hospital in Des Moines, Iowa.
So, and your friend was also a nursing cadet?
My friend was from New Hampshire. Because I had been working in New Hampshire for about 2 years, 3 years, and then I went back to Iowa and worked just a short time before I decided to come.
What year did you finish your nursing program?
It must have been 45, January of 45.
And then what type of work were you doing?
I was doing obstetrical work before I came up here.
Was that your plan, your intention to do that in Alaska? Or were you just ready to do anything?
I didn't know what I was going to be doing in Alaska. I just happened to visit a friend in New Hampshire. And when she was showing me the hospital, they asked me if I'd like to work. And I said, sure. But I didn't have my license. And they said, that's okay. Well, you can work as a graduate nurse. And so I did that. And I took my nursing license in New Hampshire. Then I went back to Iowa and got reciprocity with Iowa, which was kind of odd. And they put me in OB because that's where they needed help. So that's how I got into obstetrics.
The baby boom.
Yeah.
So and then the program that you applied to work in Alaska, so that would have been like the public health?
Yeah.
No.
Well,
or
in my last 6 months of training, you could choose Navy, Army, Indian Service, or stay in your own hospital. And I decided to go to Indian Service just because it was different, I guess. And so I spent 6 months in Pine Ridge, South Dakota. And that's what kind of got me into the public health service.
So that was like a required part of service.
The 6 months was part of the three-year training.
What was that like on Pine Ridge? And so that
pretty isolated. It was during the war. We didn't have transportation out. And it was interesting, the treatment. We only had one doctor. And we were still students, but they only had one registered nurse. So we were doing nursing, covering the floors and doing everything.
At a hospital?
Yeah.
So that must have seemed even at the time inadequate or...
Well, you know, our training was so much different than it is today. We even practiced on each other and we did things on the ward. And when we got capped, we were put on a ward in charge. I mean, we'd be the only, there'd be a supervisor floating around, but we would be the nurse on that ward.
What does that mean, being capped?
That's when you get the nursing cap, which nobody wears anymore. You got the cap at 6 months. Then after a year, you got one band. Then you got two bands. Then when you graduated, you got a wide band.
So is that a federal thing, or is that nursing in general?
I think that was the general rule for nursing back then. And if you did something wrong, they'd take a band away, and that kind of pointed a finger at you.
Wow.
Yeah. We were always under scrutiny.
Even on Pine Ridge?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
There were high standards.
Yeah.
Just not very many people with.
But we did. You know, we did exams on OB patients. The doctor didn't come and sit there. You called him.
Did you ever feel a little insecure being...
I don't know. I don't feel we had time to be insecure.
Just work to be done.
Yeah, because... And we didn't take care of just five patients. But maybe on the day shift, you might have five, six patients to take care of. But in the evenings and nights, you were watching, maybe with an aide, the whole dang ward. And that was in the days when penicillin first came out, and you gave it every 3 hours. It wasn't one shot a day or one shot several days. So you kept moving. No time for sitting around and talking.
So that was the end of your training, and then you went to New Hampshire, and then to Iowa.
To Iowa, and then here.
Got your wild hair to...
And I'm still here. Luckily.
You came up on the steamship or on a plane?
I actually came on about the last trip of Totem Air. It was a PBY that flew from Seattle to Annette, and everybody got off to go to the bathroom. Then we got back on, and people were holding jars with goldfish, fruit in boxes on their laps. It's very different nowadays. Anything you wanted to carry on, you carried on.
And I imagine PBY was probably pretty loud and uncomfortable. I mean, compared to a jet.
I don't know. I didn't feel uncomfortable. I enjoyed it. Of course, it was the first real plane ride. I've been in little planes, you know, just for looking around, but this was my first big plane ride. And I went by train out to Seattle. What'd they call us? Streamliners? Or?
Yeah.
Yeah, streamliners. Mm-hmm. It was a nice train.
Do you remember, like, being really excited or...
Gosh, it's so long ago.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'd be excited. It was interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Marge, where did you come from and your training background?
Well, I was born in Manhattan, actually, New York City. But my folks, when I was maybe 3 or 4 years, moved back to their hometown, which was right up by the Adirondack Mountains in New York. And actually, the mountains started about a mile behind our house. And their families were both from this city, small city, 25,000. So I graduated from high school in 43 and went right into nurse's school at the local hospital. And I was in the cadet nurse program like Brownie was. And I graduated in 46. Stayed there for a year, and then I went back. I went to New York City. I had finished the last 6 months of my nursing school at Creedmoor on Long Island, which was a big psychiatric hospital, probably about 8,000 patients or more.
So was that a government hospital?
State. The state had psychiatric hospitals. They must have had probably 12 or 15 spread all over the state.
So what was the town that you that your parents?
Well, the town I grew up in was Gloversville because it was the main site of the glove industry.
Oh.
And that went back to the pre-Revolutionary War when they were logging. They had all these hemlock trees, so they started curing leather there. And that grew into the glove industry. And I worked as a graduate nurse at my own hospital for about a year. This is fascinating, but when I started as a graduate nurse, the work day was 6 days a week, routine, and we made $90 a month. Then I went back to New York City and worked at St. Luke's, which is up right across from Columbia University. I worked there for a year. Moved back to my hometown and worked for part of a year and came up here. It was the same thing. I had a friend who was a classmate that wanted to come, and she got here about 3 weeks before I did. And I knew I was coming to Sitka right from the first, but they didn't really say Sitka. They said, you're going to Mount Edgecombe. And I remember going to a bookstore and finding a map of Alaska. And it showed Sitka, and then it showed the mountain on Khrushchev. So I figured it was somewhere close by.
They explained very little
to you. I remember getting two or three sheets of all the things you should bring, like a two-year supply of toothpaste and things like that. Yeah.
It was
written for the bush.
Okay.
And Edgecombe hadn't been open that long. It opened in 47. They were still building the main hospital. And the part I worked in is the old single-story part, which was the old Navy hospital. And that had been turned into a pediatric orthopedic ward with 64 beds. And it was almost all TB of the bone. Age of the children was from about 18 months to mid-teens. And most of them were there for 3 or 4 years to recover. When I got here, they were doing experimental therapy with streptomycin, which was the first drug developed that was a real good treatment for tuberculosis.
What kind of work were you doing at those other hospitals?
Oh, just
like before you came to Alaska?
Outside, the psychiatric hospital was, they're all ambulatory, or most of them are. And it's just, routine care.
So colds and flu and whatever people...
Yeah, dispensing medicines and so on. And, but otherwise, I just worked as a general, on general wards. To get back to nursing school, of course, it was during the Second World War, and we had very few RNs. And so, as Brownie said, the student nurses were really... The hospitals depended on them, and we did the whole thing. You had a lot of supervision, but you took on immense responsibilities. So, and then after I graduated in the first year I worked there, there were two of us, two RNs on this ward, but 28 patients. And of course, they all were bed patients. There were no ambulatory patients, no bathroom privileges. Everyone got a complete bed bath every day.
Plus, wow.
Yeah, it was a mixed ward with surgery.
So you must have been fit.
You learned to work fast, believe me.
So why was there such a shortage of RNs during the war?
Well, because they went to service.
So they're all in the military?
Yeah.
Wow.
There were really large military hospitals that were set up in the States and then moved to the theaters. And, of course, it took a huge number of nurses just to cover that, and to teach the corpsmen how to take care of patients. There were over 500,000 casualties for the Americans in the Second World War, and probably millions that were wounded, but 500,000 died.
Wow. So the Sitka facility opened in 1947?
47. That was the pediatric section in the Old Navy Hospital. And if you look at the hospital today, there's a five-story section, and then there's a wing that goes to the south, and that was the Navy Hospital.
So it's still standing?
Oh, yes.
The old...
They use it for storage now, but we used it for years for patients.
Okay.
There were two open wards that probably we had like 24 or 26 patients in. And then there were what we call side rooms. They were two and three bedrooms that the teenagers were in.
So that old Navy Hospital was purely pediatric TB or bone TB?
The older part.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so in 1947, that was the extent of the facility here?
No. Or there was a facility over on Ellis Island. Yeah. That's right. It's where the Sealing Cove.
We had the TB in the old barrack building where the kindergarten building, where the city offices are now.
There the Centennial Building.
It was just a wooden building with the main building and then one wing. And there was a separate building for children with TB, not of the bone, but just TB. When I came, that's where I worked, and there wasn't surgery there. And so I worked on the ward, but what we did for surgery was help with pneumothorax or sterilize anything that the patients were sending out, either the sterilizer or the ultrasound. And then in September, Dr. Coddington came, and he was a thoracic surgeon. And at that time, they were looking for a surgery group, and of course, I'd been doing whatever had to be done. And I told him I didn't know anything. I love surgery, but I didn't know anything about thoracic surgery. And he said, "That's okay, I'll teach you." And so I started working with him, and we had a nurse anesthetist, and Eva Cowan was a nurse with me. I was trying to think of the nurse anesthetist. I can't remember her name.
So you had an operating room there at the Ellis Island building?
It was right by the road, and I don't know how we kept that place clean, because they did have a bus route over there for girls to get from the BOQ over to Ellis Island, and every time it went by, the dust would blow up.
The only thing that was paved in the Sitka-Mount Edgecombe area was Lincoln Street and then the ramp, and everything else was gravel.
Yeah.
And the dust was from the volcanic ash.
Yeah.
You could dust your house three times a day and it was still, by evening it would be covered with dust again. And so you can imagine trying to keep a surgery that's right next to the road clean.
And then of course, we did bronchoscopies and thoracotomies. We removed the ribs and also sections of the lung.
That were diseased?
This was over at Ellis Island, and they were still building on the new place. And at one time, there was a backlog of about 300 patients. And Dr. Coddington would look at the x-rays, and he got ridiculed for this, but he thought it would be best to admit people that could be helped rather than admitting people that couldn't be helped. And then by the time they passed on, then the others would be that much worse. So he kind of
Triage.
How awful. Yeah, to have so much need.
And then when the new hospital opened, was that about
1950?
Yeah,
April 1950.
Oh, I would think it was later, but anyway.
Well, you didn't move over there yet.
No.
We moved orthopedic had been closed with no heat before the Bureau of Indian Affairs took it over. When the Navy left, they closed it and turned off the heat. And the flooring were big squares of linoleum, so when they turned on the heat, half the linoleum squares came up, and it was a real adventure when you had a kid on the stretcher and it's bumping and jumping around when you're going down the hall. So anyway, they moved us up to, I think it was second floor, in the new hospital and renovated the orthopedic part, and then we moved back, and then they started moving the patients in from Ellis Island.
I was thinking that we moved over about 52.
No, it was earlier than that.
Maybe 51?
Yeah. No, 50. Because we were only there. Moved in April, and we were there for part of the summer, and then we moved back.
Anyway, we moved over, and then the surgery was on the third floor.
A little farther from the dust?
Yeah, that was quite a move. Quite different.
Quite a big improvement.
Yeah.
So these are two types of TB. Can you get one by being infected with the other? Or are they just completely different diseases?
Most children get primary and then TB of the bone by the vast majority.
Yeah.
So the lung, the
Wouldn't TB. Have advancing disease. It would just be what they call the primary, the first infection healed over. But by that time, it had entered the bloodstream and would settle in the on the joints and attacked the joints.
Yeah. So it was the same.
Most people think about TB as the lungs, which is true, but back then there was a lot of bone TB, and that's where Marge worked.
So it would be this, it's the same, is it a virus, tuberculosis?
No,
it's the
same bug.
Bacillus.
Bacteria. But it just does different things in different people?
Yeah, essentially. TB had been in Alaska for a long time. Mm-hmm. And when the military came in during the Second World War, they started realizing how bad it was. Towards the end of the war, they put together a group of doctors, mainly from the University of Chicago. And they did a survey of the state, of the territory, and went around it and realized how huge a problem it was.
So this was during the war or right after?
Right at the end. Mm-hmm. I would say the last year. The Alaskans had realized it before, but of course, you know, there was very little government and no money. And so their recommendations were to get some tuberculosis sands and bring these people in and start treating them. And so when the Navy moved out of what is Mount Edgecombe now, they offered it to other government agencies, and the Bureau of Indian Affairs took it. And they started the high school in 1947. By then, they were well ahead with their plans for the hospital. It was the first large, really large hospital in Alaska. There was a good-sized military hospital in Anchorage. And then in the early 50s, they built another one that was very similar in Anchorage. But the disease was so bad that after they got Anchorage open and Sitka was open, we still had 8 moderately advanced pulmonary diseases for every bed we had. And when you consider most patients were in for 2 or 3 years, it meant, you know, it looked overwhelming.
So both of those hospitals were basically TB sanitary?
Yeah, they each had a general section, which was usually about 25 to 50 beds, which this hospital had.
So was Alaska for some reason worse than reservations down south?
Well, once started, the way they lived, because they lived in small homes all together, and so if one person got it, it would probably be passed on, and that was one thing the public health nurse was involved in, was trying to explain and get them to be more isolated in their living and hand washing and all that.
But they didn't have individual rooms, so no. It was almost it was an impossible situation. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There had to be intervention of some kind.
When did the drugs come in and merely make a difference?
Well, right after streptomycin was first started being used, right at the end of the war. And one of the first nurses, the first three nurses for Mount Edgecombe, was in the Army at the time, Patsy Sarvella, and she remembered giving it when it first came out. And I remember seeing it, I think we probably were starting to use it a little bit on the East Coast. But not, by then TB was not as bad on the East Coast as it had been in the 1800s and the early 1900s. And shortly after that, they developed two other drugs that you took by mouse. And so we started giving all three drugs to each patient. But still, with that many diagnosed cases, it looked almost impossible. And then two doctors who hadn't been in the territory very long were assigned out to Bethel, and they decided to start outpatient treatment with medications. And they were pretty severely criticized because everybody thought, no, it won't work. But the Eskimo people I found were extremely, they have a lot of common sense, and they were, they understood. You could explain something to them, and they understood why you were doing it and how important it was. And within a year and a half or 2 years, all of a sudden, the incident of TB went way down.
What year was that, or what?
By the mid-60s or the late 60s.
It took that long?
We had stopped the epidemic. Oh.
Yeah.
Wow.
And there were actually fewer new cases in Alaska that year than in the Seattle jail.
Wow.
So it was dramatic.
And then, Brownie, you were saying that the patients, the original patients, had been brought down from Skagway?
Yeah, that so was in 47, because they did have a small hospital up there. And I know Mary Meehan worked up there, and she helped bring them down by boat.
North Star,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And the captain, his wife used to be the postmaster over on the island when I came. And then they moved them down, and that's when they started this up here. I think Pat Sarvella was one of the first nurses.
Yeah, she was one of the first three. They were all, the three first nurses were all from L.A. County Hospital and had been classmates.
And they had been working for the military in Alaska?
No, by that time, Pat and a friend had come up and were working for the Pioneer Home.
Yeah, and Pat was at the Pioneer Home.
Brownie, just talk about the treatments that they were doing. I mean, that seems really extreme, removing...
The surgeries?
The surgery sounds really extreme. Maybe you could tell a little bit about the types of surgeries and like when they would do that.
Well, the one thing we did was collapse the lung. The doctor would remove the ribs and collapse the lung to rest it. And after a while, a doctor's staff came up with the idea that maybe we could save the ribs and keep them sterile, and then they could go down to the orthopedic surgery and be used when they grafted the bones, when they cleaned them out. Yeah. So we would put them in vials, glass jars, and then they would, they'd be cultured, and then they'd be put in the jars and sealed and put in the deep freeze, the freezer. Then they were cultured when they came out, and then they would be ground up to be used in the kids that were getting grafts.
So what do you mean, cultured?
It would speed up the healing of the bone, that graft. And then we also did, I guess that was sarcoplasty, mm-hmm. And then we did...
You did a few pneumonectomies.
Huh?
Lobectomies and
lobectomies and pneumonectomies, like taking just a lobe or taking half of your lung, and you'd only have one half left.
So that was when it was really diseased?
Yeah.
So was the idea that that could slow down the spread?
Well, you'd remove the disease, so they'd have a better chance of getting quicker results.
Was that really common, or was it just certain cases?
It was
well,
common.
Well, we did surgery, I think, about every day. I think one day we did bronchoscopies. They would go in and put the tube down and check the lungs out to see how bad they were and all that, and take samples of the secretions to culture them. But otherwise, we were doing 2 and 3 cases a day for a while there.
We had 2 full surgeries, orthopedic and then the pulmonary. And we had orthopedic doctors that operated at least 3 or usually 4 days a week. And quite often 2 cases a day, which for orthopedics is quite a bit. And it was not uncommon to do 3 in the pulmonaries. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were... doing major surgery. All these were major surgeries.
And those were in the days when, that was before we had central supply, and the surgery people had to make up the packs and sterilize everything. And we even mixed our own procaine.
What's procaine?
It's a local anesthetic, and cocaine, and... sterile water, nothing for IVs, but you know, just for
irrigation
injections.
Yeah,
and that was about it. But everything, no throwaway stuff. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that happened in our place, which always amazed me, I think we had 9 filters for the blood transfusions. And in those days, the tubing was rubber, and you had to clean it so that people wouldn't get reactions from old blood. You'd roll it, and you'd flush it out and roll it. And then these filters had to be put in, I think it was nitrate. Anyway, they had to be in for something like 24 hours, because sometimes we'd have to go back off duty to finish cleaning them, and then you'd clean them in distilled water and all this. And because we had such a limited amount, it was just, you really had to keep track of them. We might not have had even 9. And I remember one of the girls from Massachusetts General threw one away. And oh my God. I mean,
you didn't throw anything away.
That was a tragic. I went to find out where it was. Oh, I threw it away. She said, back there, we just throw them away. And I said, not here. That's all we have. And it was strange. Some of the things that were hard to get and other things that were bought and stored and probably never used up. But It was really quite a deal, because you were responsible for the cleanliness and the sterilizing and all of that.
So nobody was standing around.
No.
Nobody was standing around twiddling their thumbs.
You didn't have to do your nails, believe me.
You worked, sometimes you worked overtime, and I don't even remember getting overtime, but we put in a lot of time.
Did you manage to have a pretty successful safety?
All the time I was in orthopedic, we only lost 1 child, which is outstanding when you consider doing major surgeries on 3 and 4 and 5-year-olds and repeated surgeries. That most of them had to have 2 or 3 surgeries or 4 surgeries. And when Brownie was explaining the bone grafts, originally you took pieces of their bone, like out of the pelvis, and they were not real successful, because you had to keep the child extremely still for about 6 weeks to 3 months to make them heal. And when Dr. Staff developed this using the ribs and actually grinding the bones and then packing it around, we think it probably caused an irritation, but anyway, you got really good bone grafts and it healed much quicker. And in orthopedic, we tried to make, since the kids were there for 4 or 5 years, we tried to make it very home-like. We dressed them every day. They had shoes. We had 2 schoolrooms. We had movies in the evenings and Boy Scouts, Cub Scouts, and Girl Scouts.
House mother.
We had a house mother that did the shopping, and on Christmas they all got new clothes and a shopping bag of toys, and we really, and the ladies in town and the school, like the high school kids in town, would come over at least once a month. We'd have a birthday party for everyone, you know, things like that. We tried everything we could do to make it home-like for them.
What about the kids with lung TB? Were there very many?
No.
I don't remember.
Very few.
There was one ward. I do not remember any surgery on kids for lungs, but they seemed like rest. Maybe they caught them early, but it seemed like rest was what took care of them. And I don't remember that they stayed in as long as the kids in orthopedic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the one thing about Ellis Island, before we had surgery, that if any of the people, the patients, got well enough to go home, there was another building on the opposite side of the road that was for well patients that were just waiting to get home. And they were up and around and didn't have quite as much supervision. But the one thing that really got me was we did have patients that would hemorrhage and die. And I remember you felt so helpless. You could put pressure on that side,
you couldn't stop it.
Suck them out, but it was, you just felt so helpless for the patient, and you knew there wasn't much to do. Mm-hmm. And the look on their faces, and it wasn't a nice thing.
For the pneumatic TB, there wasn't much you could do in general, right? I mean, the surgery.
Well, they got so bad that the vessels in the lung broke and they'd hemorrhage. Mm-hmm. There was no way of going in. It was too late.
It's so fast when it happens.
Yeah.
No way of stopping it.
I mean, just the whole, as far as like treating, somebody gets TB, there's not a whole lot you can do.
Yeah.
I mean,
there wasn't originally.
Until the drugs.
Yeah. And you got to realize we didn't have all the things they have nowadays to treat people with.
Like,
but to get back to, you know, the patients having to wait to go home, we had a teenager who lived on Nelson Island. He was ready to go home, and they wanted to send him from here to Anchorage and right out to the island in one day and not have him stay over in Anchorage. Well, every time we were going to put him on the plane, you know, we'd have bad weather and he couldn't get out. So finally I put my foot down and I said, look, we're going to send him to Anchorage ahead of time and then send him to Nelson Island. It took 3 months for him sitting around before he could get home because there was only one plane a month to Nelson Island. And that's what we were up against all the time.
Wow.
And we didn't have the type of planes that you have now either. No. So things were different.
Our first jets came in the 60s.
The bone TB, like what were the symptoms and what were the treatments?
Well, if they had TB of the spine, they would get a hump on the back. And
so does it weaken the bone? Is that what it does?
It actually eats the bone.
Yeah.
And starts in the joint space. And with hips and knees, why they would start limping, and it would be red and swollen, and then eventually it would form pus pockets, and they would break through the skin, and you'd have these, what we call draining sinuses, that you had to clean up several times a day and redress.
So what was the treatment, like when?
Well, rest and then surgery. You had to do surgery on them to repair these bones. If you let the spine go too far, they would be it would collapse and they'd become paralyzed.
What is the actual mechanism of a bone graft? How does that work?
It's a replacement of bone.
Yeah.
But you have to keep it in contact with the bone that's not diseased to let the cells grow together, just like a fracture on each end of it.
Okay.
And that's why the bone that was crushed worked so well, is because it had all these surfaces and you could actually pack it around the bone you were dealing with.
How would they hold it in contact with the bone?
You kept them on what we called frames. They're pipe with canvas stretched very taut. And they laid on this either on their backs or their stomachs for 3 months. And you turned them every 2 hours.
Yeah.
And of course, we didn't have any lifting equipment. So that was all, you know, you taught them to stiffen their backs and you held your both arms out and would roll them into your arms and then flip them over.
Wow.
And most of the time, it should take at least two people on a small child and more on a larger person. But with the number, you know, the number of employees we had, lots of that you did by yourself.
Wow.
Yeah. It was a lot of physical work.
It sounds like there was, you know, shortage of people and shortage of supplies. Was that, do you think, an Alaska thing? Or it was just... because it's overwhelming?
No, it was pretty routine in hospitals. The psychiatric hospital I worked at Long Island, there were always certain wards that were short. Actually, we had an aide that was made sure that where she was working was stocked. So when she'd get one floor stocked, then we would move her to the worst floor. When she got that one stocked, then we'd move her again.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was chronic in those days. You've got to realize we were just coming out of the Depression.
Well,
and then
the war.
Then the war took all the supplies.
Yeah,
and it wasn't bright and rosy as soon as the war was over. It took, I would say,
rations.
A good 8 to 10 years to switch the economy and really get things evened out again. So that meant it was, you know, mid-50s before things started really getting better.
I actually took my surgery training in a Catholic hospital. We'd travel from Broad Lawns over to the Catholic hospital, this friend and I, and they were actually washing the 4x4s they used in surgery. They'd wash them, and they had these boards with nails, and then they would stretch them to let them dry, and then in your spare time, you would fold them back so they could be used in surgery again and sterilize them.
What's a 4x4?
It's a gauze that's folded, so it's a 4x4. You can buy
inches.
Them nowadays.
Yeah.
Wow.
A bandage, yeah. Or whatever you want to call it.
That's how things were, believe
me. Wow, because it doesn't seem like gauze would take very many washings.
I don't know, but we did it.
Were the patients all Alaska Native?
The majority of them were, yeah. Mm-hmm. We had a couple that weren't, and there were some in the sand that weren't.
At that time, there were very few people went to Edgecombe. The people in town went there if it was an emergency, but most people, well, they did surgery at the Pioneer Home for a while, and then people went over to Juneau.
Yeah, there was no Sitka hospital at that time.
Yeah. that came later.
For some reason, I'm remembering, like, Joe Ashby had TB and went south.
Yeah, there were beds in Washington State and Oregon and Chicago.
Joe, when he came back after treatment, that's when I first met him. He did come over there for pneumothorax because it was the only place. That's where they inject air between the ribs and the lung to collapse it for rest.
The problem with pulmonary TB is you're breathing all the time. So the tissue would start, microscopic tissue would start to heal, but then if you took a deep breath, it would tear apart. And that was the theory behind collapsing the lung.
Did they ever do ultraviolet light therapy on the island?
Just for the, we did that on the things that the patients made, you know, like sometimes they'd make billfolds, kind of occupational therapy, I guess you'd say.
Oh, to sterilize.
And if they wanted to send out, then things that couldn't be sterilized were put under the lamps. But that's the only time that I know that they ever used them.
Mm-hmm. We didn't use it.
And that was part of surgery. Was just sterilized.
I just remember seeing or hearing that, like, at Tilly Paul Manor, it was the old Sheldon Jackson infirmary, that they had lights set up for therapy.
Yeah.
But that wasn't something that was done.
No.
You know, where the patients would sit under a light. Okay.
You had to be careful about ultraviolet in your eyes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. You can burn your eyes real easy.
Reading about TB sanitariums, like, in Europe and I think it was Washington State, where they would have the patients go outside and...
Oh, that actually started in New York State. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Trudeau, this was back in the 1800s, after the Civil War. Mm-hmm. And he had it himself and moved to the Adirondacks because the air was so much better, to Saranac Lake, which is just beyond Lake Placid. Mm-hmm. He actually got better, so he opened up, started a sanatorium, built what he called cottages with porches, and the patients were treated by being outside most of the time. And, of course, Saranac Lake is one of the coldest places in the Northeast. Yeah. I know just 2 weeks ago it was down to minus 29.
Well, our hospital had a TB wing, and we trained there. But they had a large sun porch, and we would push the beds out with the people on the sun porch every day so that they could be out in the sun. That was supposed to help them.
They would spend the day out there, essentially.
Mm-hmm. But
and on bed rest.
Bed rest and sunshine was supposed to be the
and food.
Treatment.
Yeah, good food.
Yeah.
They tried.
So the sunshine wasn't real
ultraviolet.
Useful in...
Maybe
in
that's
Sitka,
where they got the ultraviolet thing.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. And right after Dr. Trudeau started, and they started developing sands in what was the territory of Arizona at the time, with the same idea, you know, clear mountain air and so on.
Obviously, it's really hard seeing people... you know, die. And then it must have been, I can't imagine asking a 3-year-old to stay still for 3 months.
I
that
know.
Must have been really hard too.
They were great kids, I'll tell you. And of course, you know, we would do our best to entertain them. The older kids would play with them. And we had one little girl. This is when things were really much improved. It was after I left. And she was a young teenager, and her friends were all ready to go home. She had to have one more surgery. And she really got depressed. Well, what she wanted was a pair of red shoes. And so they found them for her. When she woke up from surgery, even though she was barely conscious, they put the red shoes on her, even though she had to lay there on the frame. And it perked her right up, and, you know, she came out of it, made it home.
Oh.
Yeah. So there was all this personal, you know, contact. And we wrote letters to the parents, and they would write back and send things. I remember getting packages with seal oil and with the whole package soaked with seal oil.
Post office didn't care for that. if it broke, all the mail was smelled like seal oil.
So it would be like a glass jar that had broken?
Or just leaked from shaking around, you know. Yeah.
And they used to send, the TB, they sent ivory pieces that the parents would send them down, and they had a little gift shop over there, and they were really nice pieces of ivory. I think now with the tourism, they don't make it quite as nice because it's more commercial.
Yeah.
But they had really a nice selection of gifts over at the little gift shop. Well, it wasn't a shop, it was just a cupboard, a glass enclosed area where they were displayed.
So that would be the parents just using that as an outlet to sell their work?
Yeah.
Well, then the money went to the patient, so they'd have money.
It was a way of making a little money.
So the bone TB, that was, those kids were here for a while, but they went home.
Yeah.
Eventually. That wasn't as fatal as...
No. It would be over a long period of time, but you had time to work with them and to stop the disease and try to correct their deformities.
Because I know my Uncle George Longenbaugh came to work, you know, with the...
That was after the Sitka Community Hospital opened.
That was pretty late.
Oh, okay. I thought he had come originally to work at Manitoba.
When he originally came over there, it was after the big turmoil.
It was after I left. Yeah. I left in spring of 1956.
What was the big turmoil?
Oh, disagreements between the doctors and the nurses stayed out of it. A lot of personality involved and criticism of each other, and it just...
So doctors and surgeons not getting along?
Yeah. And
how extraordinary.
I can remember our director of nurses. She was great, Annie Hearn. And she got us all together and she said, "Now look," she said, "don't any of you join in, have a voice and opinion. You can think what you want." And those were real wise words. Yeah, and so it was a bad time over there.
And this was in the early 50s?
Well, I left because...
No, it was more in the mid-50s.
I left before Marge. I left in 57.
No, I left in 56.
Oh.
You left right after I did.
Yeah. Well, I left because they pushed me.
How was that?
Well, I got stopped in the hallway one day by the director, and she said that she wanted to speak to me. And she didn't even take me into a private room. She said, "We're thinking of removing you from surgery." And then I ended up going to the head honcho, Mr. Blood. And at that time, Mr. Rinderneck was a personnel person. He went with me, and the deal was, it was political. I only had a 3-year nursing degree, and there was somebody that wanted my job who had a 5-year, they had a degree.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they offered was I could be a floating supervisor or stay in surgery as a staff nurse, and I really blew up on that one. And I know Mr. Rinderneck, he couldn't understand it. He said, "You mean after 7 years working in surgery that she's not capable of running it?" And at that time, I was working with the girls in the central supply. We set up a central supply. The TB hospital is more or less defunct, and then orthopedic. But anyway, they insisted that they were going to get rid of me And so I finally said, well, I'll leave. Although some of the people kept asking me, did you leave or did they fire you? I don't know, but I said I was gone.
Brownie was head nurse and had all these things that she was responsible for. So and who, I was head nurse was and, pardon?
Oh, who was the head nurse?
Brownie was.
Oh.
For surgery.
Uh-huh.
And so there were two head nurses in the SAN, and I was head nurse. Yeah.
Well, what was?
An orthopedic, and part of the time I was head nurse for the general hospital beds. Yeah. And essentially the same thing happened to me. I could do the orthopedic work, but I was a 3-year graduate and I didn't have a degree. Yeah. And so I couldn't be the orthopedic supervisor, even though I could do the work.
What was really strange, about, kind of funny about the whole thing was, ended up the lady, and I knew who she was, and she'd been up north somewhere, but she ended up getting married, so she never did come down. But anyway, I was gone. And I kind of knew I was going to leave because the hospital was opening over here, and I thought it'd be a good change. So then I moved across the bay, the channel.
And ran the surgery in Sitka Community Hospital. And then she gradually moved up till she was running the whole hospital. So much for not having enough education, Brownie.
Yeah, it was quite a strange ending for my career on Edgecombe.
Wow. So the Sitka Community Hospital opened in the mid-50s.
Yeah. When they realized that the pulp mill was going to go in.
Oh, so that's planning ahead.
Oh, so they realized we had to have a hospital, and that's when they started building it. It must have opened in, 57.
57, I think it was April.
Yeah.
I went over, and Sister Ruth was going to run it, but I went over when they were still putting beds in. There was still paper on the floor. The contractors were doing a few things. And I remember Rose Marvin sewed drapes for surgery and sewed curtains for the windows. And it was just getting, and then there was supplies from the old Army hospital and excursion and that was sent over up to Sitka Community. Strange, but they had rocking chairs, so for a while, I've often wondered what happened to them. They were really nice rocking chairs. There was one in every room, and they had narcotics. You wouldn't believe the way they handled, nowadays, you'd be... But there were all kinds of things came from there.
So when you first went over, you were in charge of the surgery?
When it opened, I worked in surgery, yeah.
And then when did you start running the whole hospital? When was that?
I'm not good at dates.
It was either probably about 1960, I think. 1960?
No, it's before then.
Okay, so late 50s.
57.
It opened in 57, so it must have been, she was here for a year or 2 years?
A year.
Yeah.
So it was probably
58
or 59.
And then for how long?
7 years.
7 years. Wow. So there.
I think I lasted longer than anyone has. But back then, we had no dietitian, we had no medical supply person or pharmacist, so I ordered drugs, I ordered medical supplies, and I filled in, I cooked, if we were short of cooks. I did the laundry.
You've got to remember, this was pioneer days, Rebecca.
Yeah, not so long ago.
I never did do x-ray. That I never learned. But we had a little instruction in our student days with a lab, and I did very minimal because we had a lab technician that packed up and left without telling anybody, but I happened to see him go with his suitcase.
Wow.
Anyway, that was lucky because Betty Jo Whitcomb she'd come over and help at the community, even though she was working over there. And then a couple moved back here, and he was a retired lab and worked for a while until we found somebody. Yeah. Mary Ann Kelvin worked there as a lab tech. Yeah, I remember sitting, maybe I shouldn't say the name, but with a friend who had a child. And that was the beginning of getting people up because she had the baby. She stayed there that day, but by evening we had to take her home.
Because you didn't have enough room or...
Well, Tilly Paul was
Tilly Hall.
Part of Sheldon Jackson High School.
Oh.
And they just, out of the goodness of their hearts, if somebody was...
Yeah, it was an infirmary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they couldn't really keep anybody.
Yeah. So. And it was the same thing with the Pioneer Home. It was an emergency if you used it.
Yeah.
The Salvation Army did take in mothers in labor. And I know one of my friends had her first baby there. Hmm. Yeah, there weren't many facilities, believe me.
But yeah.
Then after we got search, the big part of the search now, and had the general beds, and it was always a balancing act, you know. 1 6 months they'd say, yeah, you can take patients from Sitka, and then all of a sudden they say, no, you couldn't, and...
Well, I know.
It was just, you know, you never knew where you stood and what you could do.
There was a time there, I know, when I was in charge at community, if a native lady married a white man, then she had to come to community. But if a white lady married a native man, then she could go over there. It was very distinct what you could do. And this can be off the record, but I guess that's why I'm kind of prejudiced about them now when they open it up for white people when this hospital is struggling.
Yeah, it's an ongoing
issue.
The reason they're doing it is they're struggling too.
Mm-hmm.
And I know we even talked to them during my time about combining, and they didn't want anything to do with us. And that's, I'm totally against having one hospital.
Just because of this history of...
Yeah.
Yeah. There's too much government mixed up in that.
Mm-hmm. Essentially, that's why I left the hospital over there, because when we started, Washington, D.C. hardly knew we existed, you know, and we just went ahead, did the best we could, and did what we thought was proper. And by the time I left, we were getting, more and more bureaucratic, and I'm not the type for that.
Yeah.
So did the big doctor dispute that you were talking about in the, early 50s, mid-50s?
Mid.
So did that kind of work itself out? Did some of the doctors leave?
Yeah,
or
some of them left. And later on, they sort of sorted it out and realized what they had done.
Well, you know, even employees at one time, I tried, because some of our specials, like anesthesia and x-rays, those people, there was only one on either side, meant they were always on call. And back there, when you were on call, you were by a telephone. You didn't have a beeper or anything. And I know at one time with the anesthetist, we would let him go somewhere if we knew where he's going, and then we would send the police out to get him if we needed him. Mm-hmm. And the thing was, they would not cooperate so that we could work together. And then one day, their anesthetist was sick, and they called and asked if our anesthetist could come over and help. I said, well, on one condition. We're going to talk about this and arrange for them to take call for each other. And then we did work out some of that some of the departments could exchange call. But otherwise, they were no.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's no fun.
There's been a lot of friction, yeah. But uh-huh. I feel a lot of it's the government.
Or
the people, the people working for the government, they won't bend. Mm-hmm.
To get back to the way things were, Dr. Coddington, who was our pulmonary surgeon and, of course, did surgery all the time, was also a private pilot and had his own plane. And so for recreation, he would fly, but he always stayed where he could see the one wing of the hospital. And he would tell the girls, now, if you need me, you hang a sheet out this window, and I'll come right back. There were no radios or anything.
Yeah. I know Dr. Bessonette would have you put a sheet out the window, too. He'd go out in a boat out of ways. Yeah.
So they would have to stay within visual.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dr. Moore was Dr. Philip Moore, and he was the orthopedics surgeon for Mount Edgecombe. And when they started the community hospital, he resigned from that and moved here to be, moved to the Sitka side to be surgeon and have a private practice.
So would Dr. Moore replace Dr. Coddington?
No, they were separate.
Separate.
Oh, okay. Dr. Moore was orthopedic and Dr. Coddington was pulmonary surgeon.
I see, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
They worked together if they needed to. Yeah. No problem.
And Dr. Moore was still doing surgery over there when he came over here as private. Certain types of surgery he would do over there.
Our first pediatrician, who is a good friend of both of us, Dr. Dave Sparling, he came in 52, and he was the only pediatrician in the territory. So he was on call 24 hours a day. And I remember him telling me, well, he didn't have to they routinely took call. The doctors, would switch it between themselves so nobody was on call all the time. But he was on call, and the surgeons were too, 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
So was being a pediatrician kind of a new thing in 1952?
Well, it was for Alaska.
Wow.
We were quite impressed. Yeah, the specialties in medicine developed during the Second World War or more. There were some specialties before that, but essentially the Second World War was the trigger.
And were there a lot of people at Sitka Community who had come over originally to work at Mount Edgecombe?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. Most of the staff had worked at Edgecombe and then moved to Community.
The other thing I wanted to ask about was polio. Was that, because that was another...
We had one epidemic in the early 50s, and it was mostly in Ketchikan, but we did have a couple of cases. And there were a few up north. But that was right at the time when they were developing the polio vaccine. Mm-hmm. And by the time I came to town to work... by the early 60s, I'm very sure we had a vaccine and started having clinics in town.
Was there like an iron lung or anything like that here? Like what kind of treatment did they have or could you do?
Vaguely, I remember, but...
I remember them bringing in a portable.
Yeah.
That just fit over the chest. But I had worked with iron lung before I came to Sitka.
Actually, when I was at Pine Ridge, polio was in full bloom, and we took Indian children up to Rapid City. South Dakota by the only car we had. The doctor and I went, and that was a shock of my life. I'd never seen this before, but that's where I saw on the doors of stores, no dogs, no Indians.
In Rapid City?
South Dakota.
Well, Sitka was pretty not good
and
when I came.
Of course, that would be back in 45. And then we came back through South, the Black Hills. It was really nice. It was gravel road, nothing there but a wooden rail so you wouldn't fall over. It was beautiful. And then I went back, and they had a big visitor center, cement everywhere.
Oh, when you went back in recent years?
Yeah.
Oh.
Ruined it.
Those signs were probably gone, though.
Oh, yeah.
So an iron lung, is that... So that's so that you can, when you're...
Yeah, it uses pressure.
Yeah.
Positive pressure, negative pressure to force the lungs to inflate and deflate.
Keep the lungs working.
Yeah.
So would that be a temporary thing, or would people
hopefully
end up...
Hopefully, but some people spent the rest of their lives in them. Now, polio, it got started right after the war, and I came in 49, and I remember we had several rooms in the general hospital devoted to it at that time. Of course, then I got up here and there was none. But it was probably 52, 53 when we had that one small epidemic.
I don't remember the year, but I remember helping with the little sugar mouth.
That was in the 60s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The vaccine.
First we had the injectable vaccine, and then when the oral vaccine came out, we did everything again because it was more effective.
TB and polio would have been the major diseases that we really don't
see. Yeah, they were both infectious diseases, and by developing the vaccines for them or the drugs that were effective.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And like most disease, most microbes, if you treat exclusively with one drug, then the microbes mutate, and pretty soon it's not effective, like we've done with the antibiotics. And that was the theory behind giving the three medications at the same time.
I see. And then going back to racism in Sitka, you said it was not good. Like, what were some of the
the theater was segregated. When you went to the theater, if you were white, you sat on the left side, and if you were Native, you sat on, and if you sat on the wrong side, there was comments and stares and so on. I know. Well, then, I lived through the days when it was so bad back down south. And I did my PDA. I grew up in an area that was very prominent in the abolition movement in New York, and actually had a house that had been on the Underground Railway. And when I did my pediatric affiliation at Hopkins in Baltimore the last year of the war, and was that a revelation? And of course, we had other nursing students from other hospitals in the southern area. And it only took a couple days for us to all make an agreement that we would not discuss this. Because, I mean, there was no way to talk to them about, and we had black people where I grew up, African Americans, and they were just part of the society. Because of that history, I think, of, supporting the abolitionists. Yeah. So you can't believe how different society is now than it was then. I mean, it's still not perfect and probably never will be, but it's such an improvement that...
So how did you feel like it was with the people working in that first 10 years or so when you guys were working at Mount Edgecombe? Did you feel like most of the people had really negative views of race?
No.
Or most people were more...
The staff came from what we called the outside in those days, lower 48. And so there were a few that definitely had anti-views, but the majority of them, and these people were the patients, I can't say enough about them. They were wonderful. They were so cooperative, and they understood what we were trying to do. And they've got a great sense of humor, you know. And I felt they were very easy to work with, well, didn't you, Brownie?
I think especially the Eskimos were very good patients.
Yeah.
And you enjoyed them.
Yeah. And that's why when they started the outpatient therapy, it was among the Eskimo population, and that's why it was successful. Tadine was head nurse at Barrow, and she had a fellow that was on outpatient therapy, but he was a hunter, and he had to provide for his family in those days. Yeah. That's how they lived. And so he told her, he said, "Well, I'm so afraid I'm going to forget my pills. I just take the whole handful once a day and take them." He got better. We used to laugh about that, you know.
Yeah, but they were a nice group of people.
Yeah.
I know working. And here, the people here kept a close eye on what was going on over there. They were just looking sometimes for trouble.
Yeah.
The people here, you mean in just Sitka residents?
A certain group of them. Not all of them.
But
you've got to realize this was common all over the United States then. Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of discrimination. I remember when I came, I don't remember who was with me, we went to the theater, went upstairs and picked out a couple seats, and turned out we had sat on the native side. Mm-hmm. And when we left, we got comments from both sides.
Yeah. My father's mother was Irish. Came over on a sailing vessel when she was 7 years old all by herself. She had siblings in Syracuse, New York. Can you imagine that? Took her 6 weeks from Ireland to New York or Boston, wherever she came in. But anyway, and he was very Irish. So he was only half, but he felt he was Irish. And he would tell about seeing signs that help wanted, no Irish need apply. So it was just, it was a common thing because people didn't move around like they do now. Mm-hmm. And so they became, you know, when you're brought up from the time you can first understand that that group is outside or we don't do anything with them, it becomes ingrained, and that's what causes segregation.
So do you think people in town, in Sitka, felt threatened by the
Native
facility?
Not threatened. It was just it was a way of life.
Yeah.
That we don't mix. Mm-hmm. And the way I look at it, a lot of people that feel insecure feel better if they can look down on somebody else. And that's what causes
that. That wasn't true with everybody, because I had a lot of Native friends, and people that are still living remember me when I first came over there as a nurse.
Yeah, me too. And we're good friends, you know.
When I was young.
Do you mind if I tell your age?
No, I'm going to be 91 in 6 days.
6 days? Wow.
And I was 90 in November.
Wow. So it seems like it was a satisfying
time working
over there.
And when we finally got down to where you needed to have more patients coming in, it was wonderful.
Interesting. You met a lot of people. And just the fact that you were working with a different group of people, you know, like the Eskimos, the Tlingits, and their customs. They've even changed a lot through the years.
So when the whole TB thing ended, you were both working on this side.
Mm-hmm.
So, but you were still had a lot of contact with the Edgecombe Hospital,
You knew people over there, you know. Uh-huh. You got to realize Sitka was a very small place. When we came, there were 2,000 people.
I don't think there's that.
And 50 cars.
I think between the two, it was about 1,500.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, I meant Sitka and Edgecombe together with 2,000. That's right. When you're that isolated, one boat a week.
Very, very few cars, and of course the shore boats. And You'd walk, like I lived on Merrill Street. It used to be AB, you know,
ABC
numbers. And you'd walk home, but sometimes it took you a long time to get home because you'd stop and talk. Everybody was walking, and you got to know everybody.
So did it feel like two separate communities, Edgecombe and Sitka?
It would have times when it did.
At times, I call that the rock.
Yeah. You know, and a lot of it was from the high school kids, you know, when you got to high. We had three high schools because Sheldon Jackson was a high school.
Yeah.
And Sitka and Edgecombe.
Yeah.
And so there was, you know, that natural competition.
Yeah.
But it improved over the years.
But by moving to town, I think you got to know.
Yeah.
See, I lived here quite a long time before I quit over there. You get to know the town. And then I had a boat. I tried fishing, and every fisherman in town told me how to bait a hook with a herring. Everybody had a different method.
So you had to take the shore boat across every day?
Yeah. And it didn't run after 2 o'clock in the evening.
Morning.
But and we used to have to run to get the shore boat. And at that time, the old shore boat shelter wasn't even enclosed, so the wind would just blow through, and it was much colder back then. In fact, I wore a parka during the winter. But the Lawrences, they had a little black dog, a spaniel. That dog would run down and get on the shore boat. And they would wait for that dog if he was late. They'd never wait for a person. But that dog would ride on the bow of the shore boat and then go up. And I understood he'd do the island, but he'd always be at the powerhouse for lunch. And then he seemed to know what time it was time to quit, and he'd go catch a shore boat. And yet he never showed up on holidays or weekends.
So his owner didn't have anything to do with the island?
Yeah. And
no, the original owner did work over there, and he went to work. The dog went to work with him all the time.
He was perched on the bow of the boat, and he got excited about a seagull, and he fell over. And they went back and got him. You know, I thought to myself, I bet if that was a person, they'd probably
keep going.
Yeah, he was well known.
So did you live on the island or over here?
I started on the island, and I moved to town in 55.
So when you were still working on the island?
Yeah,
so
I commuted.
Oh, and when we moved to the end of the BLQ, they didn't have furniture as such. So you could do whatever you wanted to, and we'd build furniture out of stumps. And the old hangar had all kinds of leftover stuff, and Mr. Green took care of it. And you could go there and get paint or whatever you wanted. Gosh, we'd build tables. One of the girls put tape up and made green stripes on her wall, and you just did
that. Was hangar number
whatever
3.
You wanted to, but then somewhere along.
And it was over towards where the airport is, and it was never finished. They were building it, and then all of a sudden they decided to pull out of Sitka when they removed the Japanese from the
Aleutians.
That's
where the water works.
Yeah.
I think
close
somebody
to where the sewage plant is now.
Yeah.
Like Brownie said, it was full of goodies. I can remember going over there after I put up a Christmas tree, and they had all this fiberglass insulation, and just taking enough of it to put on the tree, you know.
So that was the option. If you lived on the island, you were living in the BOQ.
Yeah.
So in dorm rooms, basically.
The BOQ is what is the community health building now. And then gradually they remodeled the Army barracks on Charcoal and Ellis Island. And then as the staff increased.
Yeah, staff increased.
Yeah. So eventually it was close to 2,000 people lived over there. And it was because there were no rentals or very few in Sitka.
And then they got furniture all alike for all the rooms. So you had to get rid of your good furniture just so they could put in that government stuff.
And that was when you decided to move to town.
Yeah.
Not too long after that.
Time to get out.
Yeah, we could feel the hot breath of government breathing on us. Did you have any idea what we were getting into when we came?
When I came, not really. Of course, I thought I was going to Bethel, so I didn't have any idea what this was going to be like.
I had no idea. I had never been west of the eastern part of New York State. I'd been as far as Utica, New York. And so I left from Albany, which is the state capital, by plane. The terminal was in a warehouse with just some, like, beach chairs to sit in. I left at 11 or 11:30 at night and got to Seattle at 3 in the afternoon. We had to make 5 stops along the way for fuel. Stayed overnight. Got Pan Man, stopped at Annette, went to Juneau, stayed overnight, and then flew over here to Grub and Goose. Yeah. And I had no idea. I mean, the climate, they didn't tell you anything. And it was like, it really didn't enter their mind that Southeast was different than the bush, you know. And really, it was just a different world.
Totem Air was ran by some veterans, and after FAA closed them down, then we had to take the Goose between here and Juneau and make connections. Carsat Airline quit running completely, too, the big commercial. Pan Am is the one that closed down, that's what we...
But then eventually another one came in, there were two at the time.
And then we went by PVY later to Annette, and then down or up from Seattle. That was the other thing, even after the hospital here opened, if somebody needed to go south, like a patient, a nurse would go with them. And now this is like people that go by Guardian now. The Alaska Airlines, or whatever airlines are before that, they just put 2 seats down so they could lay a stretcher on it. And then you would go to Annette and lay over and catch the plane. And you always had that worry about, you know, if the weather was bad, you might get to Annette and have a sick patient, and you might not get out again.
Yeah, I took a baby that was in bad shape, but I went to Juneau so we could put the baby in the native hospital over there overnight. And then we were sending the baby to the Tacoma Bureau of Indian Affairs. So then I got on the plane the next morning, and it was a long trip, believe me. And the baby was bad enough that we had to call an ambulance to get us to the Tacoma Hospital. And at that time, he landed at Boeing. There was no SeaTac. Yeah, it was a hairy deal if you had to take a patient south.
I know there were trips up north with patients when they were going home. I never got one.
Yeah, but I didn't.
Some of the girls did. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Of course, being in surgery, you didn't get to go very often. Lots of changes.
But it just sounds like a heroic time, you know, those that...
It was, but at the time we did, you know, it wasn't to us. We were just doing what we had to do.
I look at pictures. It used to be when you traveled, you'd wear a hat and, you know, dressed up.
I remember coming back.
Now you get on with jeans and...
I came back one time and I was still dressed like I dressed when I was in New York. And the Grumman used to come down here at Watts Petrol. Now it was Standard Oil in those days. And there was a little float and they pulled up on that. And my friends were down to meet me, and I had this beautiful brown hat with a pheasant feather that came over like this, and a green velveteen coat. And they looked at each other and said, I guess she didn't make it. And they didn't recognize me in my New York clothes.
Yeah. Or if you did dress up and go to town, they'd ask you where you were going.
Yeah.
At least they did me, because I usually wear no fishing clothes.
Different world, girls.
Wow, well, thank you so much.
You're welcome. It was enjoyable. It's always fun talking about old times, seeing what you can remember.
This has been an interview by Rebecca Polson with Brownie Thompson and Marge Ward, recorded January 2016 at Raven Studios, Sitka, Alaska.